Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A UN-led plan for Ukraine launched on Monday to provide immediate economic help and longer-term assistance to millions of people left struggling to meet basic needs as a result of the Russian invasion. The UN Development Programme, or UNDP, aimed to counter the devastation that's been caused by the shelling of cities and early projections that two decades of economic progress could be lost if the war continues. The announcement came as the World Bank issued an alert that Ukraine's economy is set to shrink by 45% this year because of the war. Hit by unprecedented sanctions, Russia's economy has already plunged into a deep recession, with output projected to contract by 11.2% in 2022, the World Bank also noted. Launching the UNDP initiative, its agency chief, Achim Steiner, said that the UN remained committed to helping local economies in Ukraine so that people's jobs were protected. The war continues to inflict immense human suffering, Mr. Steiner said, adding that 9 out of 10 people are at risk of falling into poverty. In Brazil, a top rights expert appointed by the Human Rights Council has spoken out against appalling levels of violence faced by activists, women journalists and indigenous communities there. Traditional communities, and in particular those of African descent, face the greatest threats, said Clément Voule, who's the special rapporteur on the right to peaceful assembly and freedom of association. He was speaking at the end of an official visit to Brazil, where he urged the state to create a safe and enabling environment where people could express their views freely. The special rapporteur highlighted the frequent and excessive use of force by law enforcement during protests, and said that violence against politically elected leaders, in particular Afro-descendant and trans women, posed a serious threat to political participation and democracy. Ahead of general elections in October, Mr. Voule urged the state to ensure that all polls were non-discriminatory, free of misinformation, fake news and hate speech. He also called on the Brazilian authorities to protect candidates from any threats or attacks online and offline. COVID-19 vaccines have been distributed to nearly every country around the world in the last year, but more than 20 still have less than 10% of their populations protected, the UN Health Agency, WHO, said on Monday. At a meeting of the World Health Organization's Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, they said that the most vulnerable populations in these 21 countries were still at high risk from the coronavirus. More widely, the WHO panel noted that available data indicated that vaccine protection among high-priority groups was insufficient to provide protection against severe disease and death. Health worker vaccine coverage is 65% globally, but this level falls below 50% in low- and middle-income countries, and vaccine coverage of older adults is 69% globally, but as low as 24% in some regions. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, he wanted to go to the Capitol on January 6th, Donald Trump tells the Washington Post, but Secret Service wouldn't let him. He hated the violence and was furious Nancy Pelosi wasn't putting a stop to it. He doesn't remember getting many phone calls, and he didn't destroy any call logs. Trump would lie on credit when he could tell the truth for cash. So why are so many pundits invested in suggesting that he can never be legally brought to account? We'll hear from Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, about the stunning new ruling that shows a way to do just that. Also on the show, polls show 68% of people in the country think marijuana should be legal, the highest number since polling started in 1969. The tide is turning. It's just a matter of who we let be lifted by it and who we allow to drown. Should some people get rich selling weed while others rot in jail for it? That's what the MORE Act that just passed the House tries to address. We'll catch up with an expert on marijuana legislation, Mike Lazuski from the Enact Group. That's coming up, but first a look back at some recent press. The confirmation of Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court occasions a look back at some of the media coverage of her hearings. While media reported GOP senators' grandstanding harassment and aggressive repetition of baseless accusations, their need to always be signaling balance led to some mealy-mouthed avoidance tactics, like C-SPAN's tweet describing, quote, heated exchange between Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson and Senator Lindsey Graham on child pornography sentencing, close quote, when anybody watching would tell you that only one side was heated. Or this piece from the Washington Post in late March that begins, quote, as Ketanji Brown Jackson this week sat through several days of hearings in her bid to join the Supreme Court, Democrats proudly took turns reflecting on the historic example she sets and the need for the judiciary, much like other institutions, to better reflect the diverse public it serves. At the same time, some Republicans repeatedly suggested that the first black female high court nominee was soft on crime and questioned whether critical race theory, an academic framework centered on the idea that racism is systemic, influenced her thinking as a judge. Close quote. You might think this says, Democrats noted correctly that there are no black women on the Supreme Court, while Republicans showed part of the reason why, by inappropriately linking black people to crime and to their own weaponized rendering of an intellectual framework. For the Post, though, quote, the disparate treatment underscored the extent to which race hovered over the four grueling days of Jackson's confirmation hearings this week, serving as both a source of ebullience for the judge's supporters and an avenue for contentious questions that sometimes carried racial undertones, close quote. So it wasn't a series of racist attacks on a black woman in an attempt to deny her advancement. It was race itself hovering, both over those who want to see an end to decades of discriminatory exclusion and those who don't. And when Marsha Blackburn asked, is it your personal hidden agenda to incorporate critical race theory into our legal system? And Ted Cruz demanded to know if she thought babies were racist. Well, those would be some of those contentious questions with racial undertones, leading one to wonder what a racial overtone would look like. The word racist does appear in the piece in senators' own descriptions of the 1619 Project and critical race theory, and in reporters' own statement that, quote, Republican senators who would go on to question Jackson most aggressively acknowledged that they could be perceived as racist in doing so. Close quote. This sort of coverage may not come off as mean-spirited, but its purposive timidity and awkward even-handedness ultimately provide cover for ideas and tactics that should be ruthlessly exposed for what they are. The time to talk about race hovering over things is long past. And Counterspin mourns the death of Eric Bollert, who died in a bike accident this week at the age of 57. Bollert was a smart media observer and critic, most recently at his own site and newsletter Press Run, before that at Salon, Rolling Stone, and Media Matters. You can find several interviews with Eric Bollert in the Counterspin archives, including one from back in 2006 on his book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush. He'll be missed. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When a judge, having seen confidential documents, declares the former president likely committed federal crimes in an unprecedented effort to overturn a Democratic election, how would you, as a media outlet, alert readers to the remarkable development? If you're USA Today, you choose the headline, "The January 6th Committee Got a Boost from a Ruling on a Confidential Memo," and describe the judge's ruling as, first of all, quote, a win for the committee, close quote. Some media's insistence on treating the crisis represented by the January 6th coup attempt and the ongoing Stop the Steal disinformation campaign as a beltway spat is bizarre and disheartening. Fortunately, many others concur strongly with the thought expressed by U.S. District Judge David Carter in that ruling, quote, if the country does not commit to investigating and pursuing accountability for those responsible, the court fears January 6th will repeat itself, close quote. Marjorie Cohn is professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and a former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She's author of a number of books, including Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. She joins us by phone from San Diego. Welcome back to Counterspin, Marjorie Cohn.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Okay, this 44-page ruling from a federal judge, David Carter, was about whether Donald Trump's lawyer, John Eastman, an architect of January 6th, had to hand over documents to the House committee investigating it. Eastman said they were protected by attorney-client privilege, and it was in explaining why they should not be that Judge Carter provided what I've seen you and others describe as a roadmap to bringing charges against Trump and potentially others as well. Is that correct?
That is correct, Janine. Eastman was claiming that he and Trump share the attorney-client privilege and also what is called the work product doctrine, which would shield them concealing, basically, communications that had to do with criminal activity on January 6th. Well, there's a crime fraud exception to both the work product doctrine and the attorney-client privilege, and that basically says that if the communications are made in furtherance of illegal activity, then the attorney-client privilege and the work product doctrine don't apply, and he has to turn over the documents. And in discussing that issue, Judge Carter found that it was more likely than not that Trump attempted obstruction of an official proceeding and that Trump and John Eastman, his lawyer, committed conspiracy to defraud the United States. Those are two federal crimes. And even though Judge Carter was dealing with a civil case, as you said, about whether John Eastman should turn over documents to the January 6th committee of the House of Representatives, his finding that it was more likely than not that Trump committed these two federal crimes is basically equivalent to a finding of probable cause in a criminal case, probable cause to support an arrest. So my feeling is that Judge Carter's 44-page opinion provides a roadmap for the Department of Justice to bring criminal charges against Trump and Eastman. Although the January 6th committee can make a criminal referral to the Department of Justice, it can't actually bring criminal charges. And there is a federal grand jury that is investigating the January 6th events and possible culprits, and that the Department of Justice could go to the grand jury and say, we want an indictment of Trump for these two federal crimes.
Well, I can see folks maybe getting hung up on the phrase from the ruling, more likely than not. Trump is more likely than not to have committed these federal crimes, but that has a particular legal meaning. That's all he can say at this point, isn't it?
It is. In a civil case, the burden of proof is a preponderance of the evidence, or more likely than not, or 51%. In a criminal case, the burden of proving guilt, the prosecutor has the burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But that's once you get to the trial stage. But in a criminal case, in order to have a lawful arrest or an indictment, the prosecutor has to show probable cause to believe that the suspect committed the crime. And probable cause is basically equivalent to more likely than not, which was what Judge Carter found. And so there is plenty of evidence for the Department of Justice to request an indictment for the arrest of Trump and Eastman for federal crimes in a criminal case, basically.
Well, let me draw you out a little bit on the obstruction of an official proceeding, because one of the things that's interesting about that charge is that it requires corruption, not just that the individual obstructed, influenced, or impeded or attempted to an official proceeding, but that they did so corruptly. And I think that hangs a lot of people up because they say You don't know what their intent was. You can't prove corruption there. But Carter says, yeah, we have other things that we can line up to indicate what he called a corrupt mindset.
Yes, and keep in mind that in a criminal case, it's rare that the defendant says, I had a guilty mind. I acted corruptly. I intended to kill the victim.
Right.
And that would be direct evidence. But there is a thing called circumstantial evidence, and that is just as strong and reliable in a criminal case as direct evidence. And what Carter concluded, basically, was that Trump knew that what he was doing was illegal, and Carter cited many, many opinions of federal court judges finding that there was no voter fraud. He cited the agency who is tasked with determining whether there's voter fraud, who concluded, no, there was no voter fraud. And Trump certainly knew that the plan was illegal. This is Eastman's plan to get Pence, Mike Pence, to either reject the electors or delay the vote count. That was the plan that constituted obstruction or attempted obstruction of an official proceeding. And then the conspiracy to defraud the United States was the agreement between Trump and Eastman to carry out this nefarious plan, which Judge Carter said both Trump and Eastman knew was illegal.
I think he also cited that call to Georgia Secretary of State Raffensperger when Trump asked him to find votes as showing that he was more interested in overturning the election and not actually investigating it. I've gotten frustrated by a tone in some reporting that suggests that we're probably never going to get anything to stick with Donald Trump, and so we shouldn't get excited about it. And I guess the implication is without an assured conviction, the whole thing is a waste of time or a distraction, or worst of all, it looks partisan. But, I mean, gosh, if this system can't determine Donald Trump guilty of anything at all, then I would think exploring why not would be journalists' job number one.
Well, I agree with you, Janine, and I think perhaps 30% of the people in this country are going to scream and yell if Trump is charged with a criminal offense, but the majority of people are in favor of the rule of law and holding Trump's feet to the fire, and the evidence of his criminal wrongdoing is legion. On Thursday, the Attorney General of New York asked a state judge to hold Trump in civil contempt for failing to comply with a court order in an investigation about whether the Trump Organization unlawfully falsified the value of assets for financial gain. And Trump's wrongdoing is out there for all to see. It has been documented for more than a year, really. And bringing criminal charges when there is probable cause to believe that Trump committed federal crimes is what the law requires. When I was a criminal defense attorney, I would have loved to hear people say, well, the prosecutor isn't assured of a conviction, so shouldn't bring criminal charges against your client. That's not how our system works. The criminal justice system, if it is indeed just, means that when there's probable cause that a crime has been committed, then the prosecutor should bring criminal charges, and then it's up to a jury to decide whether that defendant is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Do you have any thoughts for journalists who are going to be taking this up? We didn't even get to the 10 minutes of, or however many minutes of tape that no one can find, or the papers taken out of the White House or shoved down the toilet. I mean, and yet it doesn't seem to be building to the story of the scale that it needs to, at least from my view. It's not that it's not being covered. There are stories here and stories there and stories virtually every day, but I'm not sure that it's getting the push, giving the gravity, maybe is the word, that it needs. But let me ask you, advice to journalists who are going to be covering this one way or another over the next weeks, months?
I would pay attention to the White House telephone logs that the Select Committee has received showing a gap of 7 hours and 37 minutes on January 6th, which was the time that the pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol and committed the insurrection or the attempted insurrection, Trump initiated at least one call on a White House phone that was not recorded on the call log. Keep in mind that Richard Nixon resigned in infamy because of 18 minutes missing from the White House tapes about the Watergate scandal. And it may well be that the bigger story here is Trump's cover-up of his criminal activity, just like during the Watergate scandal. I think it's important to pay attention to what the Select Committee uncovers. I think they've called or interviewed 800 witnesses. Most recently, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner.
Right.
We'll see what happens.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Marjorie Cohn. She's professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and author of, among other titles, Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues from Olive Branch Press. You can find her work on Truthout, and you can also keep up with it at MarjorieCohn.com. Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
The image of marijuana a visitor might get from U.S. media and popular culture is that the stigma is gone. Tons of people admit to using or having used it, and it's practically legal, right? It's true, access to medical marijuana is now legal in most states, and 18 states, plus D.C. and Guam, now allow access for adult use. But according to Drug Policy Alliance, marijuana laws are still responsible for some 500,000 arrests a year, with, no points for guessing, black and brown people disproportionately impacted. Indeed, black people are almost four times more likely to be arrested for marijuana possession than white people, despite equal rates of consumption. And it's a leading cause of, or excuse for, deportation. Marijuana prohibition continues to ruin lives and livelihoods, which is why if the MORE Act that recently passed in the House had only descheduled marijuana from the Controlled Substances Act, it would be a lot less meaningful. We're joined now by a leading expert on marijuana laws in the U.S. Mike Lazuski is founder and principal at the Enact Group. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Mike Lazuski.
Hi, Janine. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's being shorthanded everywhere as decriminalizing pot, but the legislation is called the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act for a reason. Could you give listeners a sense of the overall intentions or aims of this bill? They're integrated, aren't they?
Yes, it's a real comprehensive approach to marijuana reform. It's built on some bills that were introduced by some of our longtime champions like Earl Blumenauer and Barbara Lee, who have really tried to make sure that the issue of marijuana isn't just about legalization and the industry, but making sure that the communities that have been harmed the most by the racially disproportionate impact and enforcement of our marijuana laws are really at the center of our marijuana policy moving forward. So the MORE Act, in addition to ending federal criminalization, it would set up a robust system for expungement. So there would be automatic expungements for certain marijuana offenses at the federal level, and there would also be funding to help effectuate expungements at the state level. A lot of states have begun to do their own expungement efforts, but a lot of times where they run into trouble is there's not enough funding to make sure that they actually take place.
Right.
So the MORE Act would help it for both federal and state expungements. And then also it would impose a modest tax on the industry. It would start off at 5% at the wholesaler level, and it would gradually work up to about 8%. And that tax revenue would go in part to the expungements, but also to help repair the communities that have been most disproportionately impacted by our enforcement of marijuana laws. So it would fund job training, community services, public health, substance abuse prevention, all sorts of things that communities that have been most harmed by our drug war enforcement, where they could use some help. So it's a real comprehensive approach to ending federal marijuana prohibition and taking accountability for the harms that 50 years of marijuana prohibition, actually more, it's 50 years since the Controlled Substances Act went into effect. But our marijuana policy has been largely one of prohibition going back to the early 20th century.
Well, as we've said, many states have passed their own laws. You just started, I think, to touch on it, but why is the federal aspect important here? What's different at having this change happen at that level?
So it is key that the states are leading on marijuana reform, because most of the arrests do happen at the state level. But a lot of the reasons why we hear in states that haven't legalized yet is that it's still illegal federally, mm-hmm. and that as long as it's illegal federally, the powers that be in those states are reluctant to move forward. And that's why a lot of the marijuana reforms that you've seen so far, they've been in states that have ballot measures. There's only been a handful of states like Illinois and New York, Connecticut, that have actually done it through their legislatures. Virginia is another. And those have all been in recent years. So we're optimistic about the trend moving forward. But many of those states only legalized through their legislature after we passed the MORE Act the first time in the House. Mm-hmm. And that was in the lame duck session in 2020. So we weren't really able to do much after it passed. But we think that the, for lack of a better word, the symbolism of the federal government beginning, Congress beginning to show that it's going to be changing its marijuana policy at some point, has inspired these states to be bolder. So once the federal government legalizes, we would anticipate that many, many more states would follow through with that.
Well, this kind of follows on from that because, you know, there is a Senate companion bill that I think originally was introduced by Kamala Harris, right, when she was a senator, and had some support from high-profile folks, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker. But the word is right now, no way is this getting through the Senate. And I just wanted to ask, you know, having done this work for some time, why do groups take on efforts where the preliminary math says you won't get through? What are the other gains?
Well, the first thing I'll say to that is when we worked on the MORE Act in the House side back in 2019 and 2020, we were told, one, it would never come up for a vote. Two, if it did, we would lose. Mm-hmm. And we got it on the floor, and we ended up winning.
Right.
So there is the whole never say never aspect to this. We also recognize the realities of the Senate and that hardly anything is getting passed. But just because there's an uphill challenge there politically, we do have Leader Schumer, who's working on his own comprehensive bill with Senators Booker and Wyden, and we expect that to be introduced sometime in the coming weeks. We do have the majority leader backing our comprehensive bill, and so I think we're going to see a lot more progress in the Senate. One thing that this issue has experienced is the House is very well versed on this issue by now. Many House members have meant several votes on marijuana issues. We've either been to their offices or other organizations working on this issue have been to their offices. Just about everyone in the House is well-versed on this. The Senate really hasn't had to consider it. And so the introduction of Senator Schumer's comprehensive bill, the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act, when that comes out in a couple of weeks, that's really going to force the Senate to consider this issue like it never had before. So while we may not see a payoff in 2022 in terms of passing a bill, mm-hmm. it's a necessary step for us to get there eventually. So we think we're going to see significant progress in the Senate. We may start to see hearings on marijuana in various Senate committees. So I think while we may not get to where we want to end up in 2022, we're going to take several significant steps towards getting to that ultimate goal.
Finally, does it matter that Biden seems to be opposed, indeed, if not in word?
It would be certainly we're frustrated with the Biden administration on marijuana so far. There was word that there was going to be clemency for marijuana prisoners. The Drug Policy Alliance would like to see everyone with drug offenses to be able to receive clemency. But the fact that the Biden administration didn't follow through even on just, you know, marijuana prisoners like they said they would, that's been disappointing. We've seen some other disappointing things from the White House in terms of security clearances. So we know that this isn't the most friendly administration on this issue, but we do think that if we have a bill that's supported by, you know, a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate, and if it was delivered to the president, we have confidence that we could get it into the law. So there are candidates who were better on this issue, but we do think that we can win Biden over.
And supported by the majority of the people in the country. Yeah, not for nothing, you know, who are meant to be informing.
Indeed, right. Indeed.
Yeah. We've been speaking with Mike Lazuski of the Enact Group. Thank you so much, Mike Lazuski, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. That's also the place to sign up for our newsletter Extra or our Action Alert Network. It's also the place to show support for the show if you're so inclined. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations says more than 4.5 million people have fled Ukraine since Russia's invasion began 46 days ago on February 24th. On Saturday, residents of government-controlled parts of eastern Ukraine were urged to evacuate immediately as Russia began a major offensive in the Donbas region. Satellite images show Russia has amassed an 8-mile convoy of military vehicles inside Russia east of the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv. Over the weekend, Russian President Vladimir Putin tapped Alexander Dvornikov to be Russia's new battlefield leader in Ukraine. The general most recently oversaw Russian troops in Syria, where he was accused of targeting civilians and medical facilities. In the Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk, the death toll has risen to 57 following a missile attack Friday on a crowded train station packed with civilians trying to flee the area. There were over 100 wounded. Ukraine and Russia have accused each other of carrying out the strike. On Saturday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson made a surprise trip to Kyiv, where he met with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
And together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify week by week the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons. And we will give you the support that you need, the economic support, but also, of course, the defensive military support, in which I'm proud to say that the UK helped to lead the way.
We'll go to London after headlines to speak with Tariq Ali, as the U.S., U.K., and allies continue to pour arms into Ukraine, Pope Francis has called for an Easter truce.
Si ripongano le armi. Si inizi una tregua pasquale.
Put the weapon down. Let an Easter truce start, but not to rearm and resume combat, but a truce to reach peace through real negotiations, willing even to make some sacrifices for the good of the people. Which victory will be the one that plants a flag on a pile of rubble?
In news from Russia, the Ministry of Justice has ordered Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and 13 other international organizations to close their offices, claiming they're violating Russian law. Global food prices have hit an all-time high. This, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. The FAO's food price index jumped 13% in March. Prices are expected to keep rising, in part due to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The two countries account for about 12% of the world's calories. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has been ousted from power after losing a no-confidence vote in parliament. Hundreds of thousands of Khan supporters marched Sunday to protest. In a tweet, Khan described his removal as a form of, quote, U.S.-backed regime change. Pakistani lawmakers are now deciding who will replace Khan as prime minister. The frontrunner is Shahbaz Sharif, the brother of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Khan and other members of his PTI party have threatened to resign en masse from parliament. We'll have more on Pakistan after headlines. We'll go to Islamabad and London. French President Emmanuel Macron and far-right candidate Marine Le Pen are headed to an election runoff April 24th. In the first round of voting, Macron won over 27% of the vote. Le Pen placed second with about 23%. Macron urged French voters to reject Le Pen's xenophobic policies.
Je veux une France qui s'inscrit dans une Europe forte.
I want a France which inscribes itself in a strong Europe, which continues to form alliance with great democracies to defend itself. Not a France that exited from Europe would have for its only allies the international populist and xenophobes. That's not us.
The leftist candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, placed third with about 22% of the vote. He urged his supporters to not give a single vote to Marine Le Pen in the runoff. We'll have more on the French elections later in the broadcast. We'll go to Paris. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris hosted Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson at the White House Friday, one day after she was confirmed by the Senate to become the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court. Judge Jackson spoke at the event on the South Lawn.
It has taken 232 years and 115 prior appointments for a black woman be selected to serve on the Supreme Court of the United States. But we've made it.
A leader of the far-right Proud Boys organization pleaded guilty Friday to criminal conspiracy charges over his role leading the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Charles Donahoe is the first Proud Boys leader to admit to plotting an attack on Congress in order to halt certification of Joe Biden's election victory. As part of a plea deal with federal investigators, Donahoe will testify against other defendants. Meanwhile, CNN reports Donald Trump Jr. texted then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows shortly after the presidential election in November 2020 with ideas about how to overturn the results in states won by Joe Biden. Trump Jr. wrote, quote, "Republicans control Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, North Carolina, et cetera. We get Trump electors," unquote. If that plan failed, Trump Jr. wrote, "Congress should intervene during its count of the Electoral College votes," quote, "We either have a vote we control and we win, or it gets kicked to Congress January 6, 2021," Donald Trump Jr. texted. In other news about the Trump family, the New York Times reports a fund led by the Saudi Crown Prince has invested $2 billion in Jared Kushner's new private equity firm. While serving in his father-in-law's administration, Kushner helped push forward a $110 billion weapons sale to Saudi Arabia. Public Citizen described the relationship between Kushner and the Saudis as, quote, "extremely troubling." The Saudi fund also invested $1 billion in a fund run by President Trump's Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. In Texas, a county prosecutor has dropped charges against a 26-year-old woman who was arrested for murder Thursday after being accused of causing the, quote, "death of an individual through a self-induced abortion," unquote. Lizelle Herrera was detained on a $500,000 bond. Her arrest and detention sparked mass outrage. She was released Saturday, hours after La Frontera Fund held a protest outside the Starr County Jail. Later in the program, we'll speak with Rocky Gonzalez, the founder of La Frontera Fund. Alabama Republican Governor Kay Ivey has signed a pair of bills targeting trans people and those who assist them. One bill outlaws gender-affirming medicine for transgender youth and makes it a felony to provide such care, while a second bill requires students to use bathrooms and locker rooms based on sex assigned at birth rather than their gender identity. An amendment to the second bill, modeled after Florida's Don't Say Gay law, bars classroom discussions of gender identity and sexual orientation for children through the fifth grade. Lawmakers in at least 19 states have recently proposed bills limiting or criminalizing health care services for trans youth. In China, authorities say they will start easing a two-week lockdown in Shanghai, where over 25 million residents have been confined to their homes due to rising COVID infections. Anger's mounting over food and medicine shortages in parts of the city. Despite the lockdown, China recorded 26,000 new infections in Shanghai Sunday. Here in the United States, New York City Mayor Eric Adams has tested positive for the coronavirus. Last week, he attended the Gridiron Club dinner in Washington, D.C. At least 67 attendees of the dinner have now tested positive, including Attorney General Merrick Garland, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. On Sunday, top White House advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci said it's now up to individuals to assess their own COVID risk. He spoke on ABC's This Week.
This is not going to be eradicated, and it's not going to be eliminated. And what's going to happen is that we're going to see that each individual is going to have to make their calculation of the amount of risk that they want to take in going to indoor dinners and going to functions.
In labor news, Amazon is seeking to overturn the recent vote to unionize by workers at an Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, New York. Amazon, which ran a multi-million dollar union-busting campaign, is now accusing union organizers of trying to intimidate workers. In other labor news, workers have voted to unionize at six more Starbucks stores, bringing the total to 16 in recent months. In West Virginia, more than a dozen climate activists were arrested Saturday as they nonviolently blockaded a coal-fired power plant that earned Democratic Senator Joe Manchin $500,000 last year. The protests targeted the Granttown Coal Waste Power Plant, which receives deliveries from Enersystems, a company run by Senator Manchin's son. Activists wanted to highlight the environmental harm caused by the Manchin family business and are calling on the senator to end his opposition to climate action in the Build Back Better Act. Federal prosecutors have been dealt a stunning defeat in the trial of four men who are accused of plotting to kidnap and kill Michigan Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer. A jury acquitted two men on all charges and deadlocked on the verdicts against two others. Defense attorneys argued the plot was manufactured by the FBI and a team of at least 12 informants who helped plan and encourage others to take part. A warning to our viewers and listeners, the following includes images of police violence. Two Buffalo police officers have been cleared of wrongdoing for knocking over a 75-year-old racial justice protester in June 2020. Martin Gugino, a longtime peace activist, suffered brain injury, a fractured skull, and spent a month in the hospital after being shoved to the ground by police. A video of the incident quickly went viral. The officers are expected to be reinstated today following the arbitrator's ruling. And Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador has overwhelmingly won a referendum on whether he should complete his six-year term. AMLO called for the referendum himself to fulfill a campaign promise to give voters a chance to remove him from office after 3 years. Early results show about 90% of voters supported him, but turnout was about 18%, with many critics of AMLO boycotting the referendum. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm your host, Mike Cadell. Coming up at the top of the hour, fellow co-host and longtime contributor to the This Can't Be Happening News Writers Collective, thiscan'tbehappening.net, John Grant will be on at the top of the hour. We've got him. We've got him on the horn. We have him on the horn. John Grant.
Hey, Mike Goodell. How's life in Kansas today? The weather here is
windy.
Oh,
I know, it's beautiful.
The weather here is just stunning. It's, you know, it's, I went out there working in the yard. It's just beautiful today. Spring is here.
Well, spring is here, but in Kansas it's mainly wind.
Yeah, we got a lot of flat land out there. That wind builds up, I guess. Yeah.
We don't have a lot of flat land, but I mean, it's coming. It is coming from the west and north.
Mm-hmm.
So where it is flat, it really is flat. So.
Right.
But still, man, my goodness. I mean, it's not fun working in the garden or driving your mower or, you know, anything when it's so goddamn windy out here.
Yeah, of course.
What's the temperature like?
Oh, well, it's lovely. It's like, I don't know, 60 here or something. Yeah, it's like.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, that's what it's like here. A lot of people at this time out here in the country, we burn things. It feeds the pyromania of politics is fed by wildfires here in Kansas. So.
Well, you know, you're rural, so you can burn something. We're suburban, so if we set a fire, you know, the police will be on us immediately. You know?
Oh, really?
A big enough fire. Of course, a small modest fire.
Yeah, well, see. So you have some freedom. A little bit.
Right.
So you can have a track. Well, we have, if it's going to be a large pasture fire or something, we're supposed to call our local volunteer fire department and give them a heads up before we do it, see what they think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They'll say, well, it's a little windy. We're not ready to go to work. We don't feel like getting on the fire truck and coming out to your place, Mike, and putting out a grass fire. Would you hold off until the wind dies down? Then we might come drink a beer with you. So do you have your New York Times?
Page? Well, the top story is, of course, on the Ukraine. It keeps up there. A talk with Putin deepens the fear of worse attack. In other words, the chancellor of Austria met with Putin and came away totally pessimistic that he's just going to double down, and he's got this new commander that's the, you know, known as the butcher of Syria, and, you know, there's all this talk that he's going to crush the southern and eastern part, Donbas areas and whatnot, even further, which he's probably going to do. And it's just, it's just, you know, really troubling to read all this, you know, to see the, you know, the confusions and the struggles and ideological struggles in the United States over this war. I went to a meeting on what Saturday it was, called the W.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson Center in West Philadelphia. Paul Robeson famously lived in West Philadelphia. And of course, W. Du Bois lived on 7th Street over in Philadelphia, you know, and wrote the famous book, The Philadelphia Negro, back in the early part of the century, I guess it was. I went there, and it's a very interesting meeting, about the left trying to figure this out. What should we do? I told them I'm not an apologist for Vladimir Putin, so if that's what you're going to drill, I'm not going to come. And they said, no, you can say anything you want here, you know. And so you get in there, and the room is full of, the complete works of Vladimir Lenin, and, you know, it has banners with hammers and sickles on it and pictures of Lenin. And so this is the commies. and they're trying to figure out what to do with this. And so it was actually a very interesting, positive meeting, I thought, because there were some very smart people there trying to figure this thing out. And you know, a lot of people are trying to figure it out, and they're coming up and with different places, and, you know, it can, you know, be quite quite interesting dialogue, I guess you could say, you know. I don't know, what do you think
Were they trying to sign people up to go fight for Zelensky?
No, none of that. They were just trying. These are people I've known for 40 years, some of them. You know, very good, gentle people, you know, and of course they may be aligned with, you know, some of the far, far left, radical left, but they're good people, and I know them. And so they were just trying to have a discussion of people to figure out what the hell's going on. And so I take it upon myself to, you know, throw in some cautionary statements about, you know, about, again, not falling into the trap of my enemy's enemy is my friend, and therefore, because I've opposed American imperialism for 40 years, I'm supposed to then find sympathy for Vladimir Putin. But, you know, so I drilled, my message was to this gang that, you know, a plague on both their houses, you know, that we need to stop a ceasefire of you know, Russian invasion, pull out of there, and then we can talk about all this stuff. We can talk about NATO expansion and all these things that people on the left want to talk about. Anyway, so it was an interesting meeting. I'm, you know, taking any opportunity to discuss this with anybody, you know.
Good.
And, yeah, so it's interesting. Meanwhile, it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it gets worse, yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of the misery of the people, yeah, it's just getting worse in terms of...
Well, this is how wars happen, you know, we get used to them. You know, you get used
to
them.
Well, I think you're onto something there. I think you're onto something there. And I think too few Americans remember... Mm-hmm. How these things tend to escalate. I think that's the old word, escalate.
Absolutely.
And another one, another term or phrase is mission creep.
Yep.
I mean, things will they change. I mean,
right.
You were at this meeting over. I believe you said it was mm-hmm. over the weekend. I mean, here was a large number of. No, of the surviving tank units and armored artillery
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. formations leaving, units leaving, leaving
right.
Ukraine, Russian tanks and units
right.
leaving Ukraine and going skirting the border,
mm-hmm.
headed basically in a southerly direction towards the Donbas, and being
right.
as your New York Times pointed out. Getting a general staff shakeup going
yeah.
on with a
oh yeah, well, yeah
a guy who has a little more experience for in carnage
right.
from Syria. I guess he's the general from Syria. Yeah, they call him.
Well, he was the general,
I mean,
responsible for Aleppo. You know, destroying Aleppo, and his forte.
Uh-huh.
You know, there was a video I saw last night of Vladimir Putin giving him the Heroes Medal from the Soviet Union or the Russia, I guess it is.
Yeah.
You know, for you know, devastation of Aleppo and killing also civilians.
Oh.
And so this is his forte, you know, and he's after, you know, we've heard this remarkable facts of, like, I think it was 6 generals have been killed in this war, you know. 6 Russian generals? I mean, that's amazing. You know, they can't protect their own leaders.
So now they
send in the butcher. You know, they're not gonna back off because they're obviously Putin is embarrassed because his army has done so poorly, given it was supposed to, you know, rout Kyiv right away, and, you know, Zelensky was going to be wetting his pants and running out of the country immediately, you know. But instead, this little fucker...
He's really
just,
getting to that, isn't he?
Yeah, this little guy has won the world over, you know. He is an actor.
No, he hasn't.
He is an actor, and, you know, he's good at what he does. You know, getting sympathy for the Ukrainian around the world.
Well, I suppose if I was surrounded by a bunch of fascists, ultra-nationalists, I'd probably perform my best I could in front of a form of the next jumbo Trump, the next jumbotron at the next parliament. I would do my best acting ability, especially if I was a Jew surrounded by fascists. You know, all my general staff.
Well, you know,
but
I think
even you know even
yeah,
wait a minute, you're
okay.
interrupting me.
Oh,
let me
excuse
just
me.
Say
I'm
this.
Sorry. Go ahead,
I mean,
please.
you did screw up and ask me what I thought about this, you know. So I mean, I could
Hey, well, let me have it. I want to hear it. Yeah.
I'll be very quick. You know, like I said, Zelensky. I mean, he's got to do this. He's got to do what he's got to do to survive. But you know, it's pretty. I've been watching, reviewing a lot of stuff. From and it's on my Facebook page, listeners. You just go to Michael Cadell, number 50, and you could go to my Facebook or just Google Radio Free Kansas Facebook, and you'll get a lot of articles from the other side, not the New York Times side, and not the Donald Trump side, and not Hillary Clinton's side, who I got to tell you, Bill Clinton is 110. After listening to Noam Chomsky in the last couple of days, I got to give it to you. I mean, here you have Yeltsin in 1995 on the hotline. According to the National Security Archives, the records are there. The transcripts of the phone conversations are there. Yeltsin at that time, drunk or whatever, repeatedly calling Bill Clinton, saying, please, Bill Clinton, please do not let, you know, can't you stop these countries from becoming members of NATO? Can't you stop? And Clinton said, no, he's not going to stop them. You know, he turned it into a political tool with the Congress. I mean, as usual, just like with welfare and jailing everybody, you know, mass incarceration, you know, Bill Clinton, I am beginning to see more and more of what a neoliberal means that with the likes of Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. And by necessity, unfortunately, Joe Biden, who let's not forget what he did for Bill Clinton. So, I mean, I tend to think that, you know, there's not any good face in this situation between and Zelensky and the Ukrainians are going, you know, to the last, as retired Ambassador Chaz Freeman said, you know, as far as the United States is concerned, they're, you know, to the last Ukrainian, they're going to sacrifice. Zelensky is a sacrificial pawn. You know, I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, that he'll end up dead because probably by his own people. And the tank columns are leaving, but they're heading right down, as you well know if you read the New York Times and or watch any of the media, they're running on a super highway right down the Russian army, right down to the Donbass region, particularly I forget the name of the city, but it's the city, you know, Mariupol is a good example. It's the bridge between the two, the Azov, the coast of the Azov Sea and the Donbass region in Crimea. So, I mean, it's, they call it a land bridge for good reason. And I think that he's going to get it. I think Putin will have this land and come hell or high water. And the second front is now going to fully develop into, you know, I think the popular term is among people, a cauldron. That is where the Russian army will surround the several thousand. Some say as many as 100,000. Others just say 40,000. The Ukrainian army, largely dominated by the Azov command structure, infrastructure, and they're going to get wiped out. It's going to be a horrible, horrible thing. They should quit. They should surrender and leave and go to
Or else it will be like in history, the Masada, you know, that plateau where the Israelis were all wiped out and massacred. You know, that these incidents become martyrdom. Martyrdom in history.
Well, they are. And, you know, some of them should, I don't know if any of them should be considered martyrs, but definitely they're certainly martyring their own people. You know, there's, you know, this thing with this train strike, this strike on this train station that killed over the weekend while you were at that meeting. You know, that bears good scrutiny because, I mean, there have been allegations from both sides, and I think there's some justification for this, that that is possible that the fascists would launch missile attacks on fleeing Ukrainians. Now, they would kill their own people in order to scare them to staying in Mariupol or any of the other cities. I think it's in the interest of the ultra nationalists, fascists, whatever you want to call them, to stop the refugees from leaving because that's their human shields. And there is a certain logic to that. It's a sick logic. It's evil logic. But I think you can't discount that. I mean, you know, they've had good teachers. You know,
it's also, if I could be frank, it's also a standard propaganda response. You know. You know, we always, everybody uses it. We do, they do, whatever. You know, if civilians are involved, you know, they're hostages, you know, instead of, you know. So, I mean, all these arguments work both ways, you know. They work. I mean, there's propaganda going everywhere. The first casualty is truth and the fog of war and all that, you know. All this stuff lives in that fog.
You've been saying this for 3 weeks. We've got to get beyond this. There needs to be real investigations.
I think they'll only rarely
happen. Look what happened, how much it took to get them to investigate the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, in your experience. I mean, it went on. It took forever to get the investigation
done. Why is that? Because it's a full-blown war. Yes.
Well, I think it's...
The fog of war and all that stuff with a full-blown war. You know, I was in communities with Brian Wilson. You know Brian Wilson, right? You know, very famous leftist friend of mine. He lives in Nicaragua, you know, and this is his line. He says, you know, we need a fair investigation. Well, yeah, but Brian, who is going to do that? You know, who is going to be a fair investigation of the Bucha, quote, massacre? Who's going to go in there and, you know, have the trust of both sides here? Nobody. And so it's just you can't get a fair investigation in there because it's a bloody goddamn war. They're killing people. And, of course, when people start killing people, Ukrainians have been... you know, doing atrocities. All people do atrocities during war. And, of course, the Azov Brigade? Okay, they're far right. There's far right people everywhere. You know, if we were invaded by Martians here, a common enemy, you know, I'd be out there fighting with the Proud Boys against the Martians, you know? You know, this idea that Ukraine is just a bunch of Nazis, to me, has an element of truth. There probably are Nazis. I mean, this area is riven with all this stuff. But there's also the nationalist unity that Ukraine is showing that just, you know, really has surprised everybody. And so, you know, they're all struggling together. Now, does that mean that the Ukrainians aren't capable of doing terrible, evil things? Of course not. They're as capable as anybody, you know. But this idea, I don't get this constant flogging of going in the back in the past and say, oh, NATO, Yeltsin, and all this. NATO was, you know, shouldn't have been expanded, and I assumed it was going to die with the Soviet Union, and of course it didn't. And, you know, they probably should have let it die, but they didn't. But the fact is, they didn't, and it exists. And now, this bloody invasion is reinforcing NATO like nothing in its history has ever done. You know, and it's like, now you want to dismantle NATO when you have a major international provocation that reinforces NATO, and that even, you know, despite what Dave says, I've read that Finland is considering joining NATO and things like that. And, you know, it just totally baffles me to, but again, you know, I'm taking not an idealistic or ideological position on this. I'm taking a pragmatic position to stop the killing, a ceasefire, and then we can talk about it. But, you know, people don't want to do that. They want the war. A lot of people. I don't know. I'm
the only people I hear.
I'm at a loss. You know, I'm at a loss. And then you know.
I the only people I hear wanting war are these news propaganda outfits in the United States, and that's the only ones I can get.
Like what?
I mean, I have to really.
Well, who's a news propaganda outfit?
MSNBC. MSNBC. I can't remember his name. He's one of the male. He was there. He is there in Ukraine, and he gave one of his moments, basically advocating just screw it. You know, let NATO invade Ukraine and duke it out. Now, that's
you know, obviously there's
now, wait a minute,
propaganda elements everywhere. You know, you read the Nation.
I mean, no,
this propaganda rag.
This is not an Edward Murrow moment. This guy was. This is not that kind of journalism.
Wait, what is this Ari or Ali? One of those guys?
Yeah, know? Yeah. I think his first name.
Ali Veshi. I think
he's there.
I don't have cable.
I don't have MSNBC.
Right.
and when I played that Max Blumenthal, I think played the clip, and there's no denying that this guy is a warmonger journalist. I mean, this guy wants the war because it drives his ratings up, and you know, and that's what's really driving this neoliberal effort in the United States.
Well, listen, you know, Mike, we may disagree on this, but you know, I was trained as a mainstream journalist. Now, that may be a crime. I was also trained in basic training to be in the United States Army. You know, so okay. Yeah, I have, you know, my life has been hooked into these two major institutions. You know, the United States Army in Vietnam and the mainstream media, you know, which I've been marginalized from. But still, you know, I mean, you know, the mainstream media is what it is. Yes, it's corporate owned. Yes, it's money driven. And yes, it is the mainstream media has taken up the cause of Ukraine. And so obviously they're going to trip over their you-know-whats as they try to fill their news hole. Because, you know, you have so much news hole to fill, you got to say something. And, you know, and so the what they want to avoid is, you know, the classic cold-hearted kind of gotcha journalism. If it leads, if it bleeds, it leads. Where, you know, the famous one was the reporter who went into a building with women who had been raped in Serbia, I believe it was, and he famously said out loud, "Anybody in here been raped?" You know, that sort of attitude of our mainstream press. You know, they're just getting the story. You know, people have gone through these horrific experiences in their lives. Their children are dead. Their mother's dead. And, you know, these reporters are, as you say, you know, they want to fill their news hole and they want to be watched. It is a corrupt system, right? But, you know, as my conservative old man would always say, you know, beware the printed word. You know, you need to be taught that, you know, you need to, you shouldn't trust things just because they're said on TV or, you know, all that stuff. And so you need to understand how propaganda works. And these days, propaganda works as simply what channel you're watching, you know, is where you're, what direction your propaganda is getting. Because propaganda, as Jacques Ellul and other people have written about, that it can be accurate information, totally accurate information. It's what's withheld and what's flogged that makes the propaganda. So yes, I mean, everybody in the business is corrupt, including the Nation, the Progressive, you know, everybody, you know, you have to be aware of all of them because they're all susceptible to propagandizing. At least that's my view. But that's not a very satisfying view. I understand, you know.
No, it's not a matter. No, it's not that. It's dishonest.
You calling me a liar?
Look, John.
Wait a minute, Mike.
The only thing corrupt about the Nation and the Progressive, besides running many Kansans and people from Pennsylvania away from those publications, which is what you just did.
You're twisting what I said. I wasn't damning the Nation. I read the Nation. I like the Nation. You know. But what, I can't watch MSNBC or I can't read the Times, you know, it's like,
no, it's not,
I don't get this.
I can't afford the publications you're talking about. A lot of people
right,
can.
Right, okay, fair enough. Yeah.
But I get, as I said, the only thing corrupted about the Nation, and I didn't get to finish it, The only thing corrupt about the Nation is their wine cruises. That's about the only thing I can
do. I know.
Yeah. They go on a cruise and get drunk. That's about the only thing I could say.
Yeah, they get
really
drunk and get laid, I'm sure. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's great stuff.
Yeah. But and as far as the Progressive goes, I used to know the people who ran that magazine.
Mm-hmm.
20 years ago. Now it's changed. It's gotten better, actually, and it's out of a strong Midwestern progressive historical culture of the Midwest. The Progressive actually comes out of the Midwest, the northern part of the Midwest.
Right. Well,
the Plains. It comes out.
Right. There's school that's with the Midwest.
These publications are. That probably, and as a matter of fact, Counterspin audio that I play in the first hour with Janine Jackson. I mean, sponsored by the Fairness and Accuracy in Investigative Reporting, FAIR. Her program Counterspin has been going on for years and years, and I wouldn't fault her because she comes from New York, or you know, so. I mean, but I would say this, that, you know, that MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, even America, I mean, we're these periodicals that you just alleged were corrupt. These tiny periodicals alleged to be corrupt are probably the only voices of sanity written with other voices of sanity in this.
Well, that's your prejudice, right? That's your political prejudice, right?
And no, I've got prejudice. That's a simple mathematical. It's now come to a time when someone like Elon Musk or Donald Trump, through Twitter, and Elon Musk, the big rumor is that the big hope, the great white hope of the MAGA world, MAGA world, is that Elon Musk is going to unlock Donald Trump's 88 million followers, who reaches more people than MSNBC.
No, I've read this. He's Twitter, all that stuff. Yeah, yeah. And what does that mean, though?
My point is that single media today is much, much more biased and blind. My major media. I'm not talking about these periodicals.
Marginalized media
that are kicked around so readily by people of both the extreme right and the neoliberals. You know, they just discount them. They don't matter. You know, but MSNBC and Donald Trump and you know nowadays these forces, CNN too. You know, it's now possible, as in the example of Donald Trump or Elon Musk, for them to have more, to amplify their messages, their biased messages. They're in, if not inaccurate.
That's why Elon Musk wants all his money, and that's why he wants to own Twitter, of course. Power. It's all power. It's not truth. It's power.
They can reach more people. They can reach more people. That doesn't, in 128 characters or 240. But either way, you know, I think they've succeeded in dumbing down the population to the point that we might
well,
as well be
but engaged. No. Listen. I don't disagree with your conclusion that we're dumbed down in many ways. We could, you know, people should write dissertations on that dumbed downness over the American culture. You know, as, you know, Sean Penn said the other day when he was on, had his moment in, you know, he was on the same night, Sean Penn, because of a film he's making in Ukraine, he was on for 45 minutes on Sean Hannity, and then in the next hour he was on for 45 minutes with Lawrence O'Donnell. Two interesting interviews. As Newt Gingrich said, it was probably Sean Hannity's best interview in his whole career because it started out, Hannity asked Sean Penn, what was the last thing you said before we went on the air? And Sean Penn smiled and he said, I don't trust you. That's the way they started the interview. It was great. It was a great interview. Because, again, Sean Hannity is all for busting the Russians versus his colleague Tucker Carlson is all for defending the Russians. It's very confusing. But you know, so all of these institutions, these journalistic institutions, are terribly flawed. I couldn't agree more. And, yeah, we're dumbed down. We're infantilized as a culture. And, of course, everybody's opposed to this. But the problem is everybody, in the way their minds work, the way all minds work, is they're looking for backfills for their sentiments, what they feel, what they're afraid of. And so they backfill it with things that, you know, with evidence that supports X is dumbing us down as a conspiracy, whereas, no, X is involved with every other goddamn letter in the alphabet, and they're all driving us into this. You know what I mean? The point is it's too confusing to come up with easy answers these days. And it just gets worse and worse and worse. And, of course, then we select what we listen to. We only read The Nation. We don't read The Times or something like that. And, you know, it's a Tower of Babel. This is why we have wars and we can't stop them. This is why Donald Trump say I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, because you know it's out of the bag. You know, the laws in America, the criminal justice system, legal system is corrupt as it comes. You don't get any worse than the United States right now. And so everybody's trying to figure out who's at fault. And, well, as Pogo said, I met the enemy and it's us, you know. It's complicated. And as a writer, I'm moving from, again, propaganda, you know, and all that, to types of writing, prosaic writing that deals with complexity. It is not so concerned with left and right or whatever. You know, it's like, how do people live in this, you know, as Sean Penn called it, this lap dance of a nation, you know?
Was he referring to the U.S. or Ukraine?
He's referring to his own fucking culture. And this guy, he had been through it. He looked feral as they come. He looked beaten. His hair was mussed up. You know, he went over there to make a film on, you know, a fellow actor. This guy is in politics, as Sean Penn's in politics. And he went over to make a film on the Zelensky, the president, and, you know, foisted into this job as a real president after he, you know, was in the comedy TV show. And so his first meeting with Zelensky was the day of the invasion. And so he wasn't over there for Zelensky and the invasion. He was over there just to do a story on Zelensky. And all of a sudden, you know, the war came up and the cameras were there. So, you know, that's what he ended up doing a story on, this guy's rising to the occasion to be president of Ukraine. And again, he's an actor, so he's a great spokesperson because he knows how to communicate, you know, not just in prose, but in acting and in the moment and body language, all these things that actors are sensitive to. And here we are, you know, here we are. We got Vladimir Putin, you know, who thought he was going to rout this guy and he was going to run with his tail between his legs, and he didn't. And they thwarted the Russians around Kyiv. So, you know, this guy is just riding high in the world's mind at the same time that, you know, Putin insists on, you know, almost medieval-type brutality to solve his problems. And you know, it's just a really, really fucked up moment. It reminds me of the opening of what is it, Vargas Llosa, the famous Peruvian novel, has a wonderful novel called Conversation in the Cathedral. I haven't read it. I've just read parts of it. But it opens up. It's got the greatest opening line is where the guy's the journalist, and he's trying to figure exactly when it was that Peru fucked itself up. You know? When in history, where was it that we really, you know, eternally fucked Peru, you know? And I don't know. I feel that about us. You know, where did we go wrong here, you know? But it's a little late to deal with that stuff because you had to be practical to stop the killing, you know, because it just gets out of hand. I don't know. I'm going off too much here, you know.
Well, I mean, come on.
Go ahead.
You used an atrocity that occurred in, I think you said Serbia or Serbians atrocities.
Uh-huh.
You were talking about a dilemma, that was caused by this outright refusal of Bill Clinton to Yeltsin. To not expand NATO. I mean, Daddy Bush.
Okay, so what? Well, so what? So my point is.
Well, here's what.
I don't
so
like
what.
Bill Clinton. I don't like Hillary Clinton.
Thing,
you know.
The first thing I think any anti-war activist okay, versus a religious peace pacifist, okay? You could join both of those people. The first thing should be we should not be sending weapons to NATO. NATO should be rolled back. NATO should be starved to death of all the weapons, his goddamn precious weapons from Lockheed Martin. The only people having office parties right now are ExxonMobil executives and Lockheed Martin executives. They are having a great time right now. They're not suffering, worrying about whether Zelensky's going to live or not. Now let's get. I mean, this is the
well.
This
the same
the
way with the rich.
Really
it's exact same way with the rich with the rich in Russia. For Christ's sakes, I mean, what the oligarchs in Russia? Exactly the same thing.
This is what pisses me off about the United States, quote, peace, unquote, movement, or the anti-war movement. I mean, and right now, I see more activism from people like Steve Bannon in terms of criticizing the war machine than
well,
I'm
right.
hearing from.
But you're right. Of course. The left has failed. I mean, that's what I try to get across to people. It's, we fucked it up. It's over. You know, the anti-war movement is a failure. War is much
in this country.
More. Right. Well, where is it a success? Wars are very popular.
Well, a quarter million to a half a million people rallied. They didn't rally for Zelensky in Ukraine and Berlin within the first days of this happening. And I got news for you. I think one of the reasons there's this utter disgust with the German Green Party right now is because they're at all odds of trying to get people to ration themselves on Russian oil and Russian energy, okay? Russian supplied energy. Here's the simple thing. You can learn something. I think
listeners can learn something from the right wing in this godforsaken country.
Probably, yeah. Sure.
Of the United States, okay? Right now there are gobs and gobs of people making homemade stickers saying, to stick on the gas pumps where they buy gas. It's a simple act of vandalism. It's not a big deal. I don't think a cop in the world would arrest you for it. But you stick a sticker on your pump when you're gassing up and says, this is Biden. Biden did this. Now, Max
what?
Blumenthal and some other people on the West Coast. Whoa.
You lost me. You're going to stick a sticker on a gas pump that says Biden? What? I don't get it.
Biden's war. Biden's war.
I just think that only fuels the war. I think that fuels the war.
And then some other people who claim to be anti-war are saying NATO, courtesy NATO, on the gas pumps. So it's very interesting. I think just in terms of sticker wars, this is the early rumblings
you're getting at what my issue is in all this, you know. As my wife would say, he has issues. I have issues. And it seems to me, because it's so troubling, right, all of this is stuff so disturbing, troubling, and frightening, that everybody wants to find some kind of instant satisfaction. Oh, God, I feel so good when I stick that sticker on a gas pump. You know, I'm doing something, you know. But at the same time, the problem seems to me exactly this urge to do something right now, radical right now, important, powerful thing to do right now, whereas it took 50 years or something to get to where we are. You don't turn it around overnight. But we have no patience for this stuff. That, you know, in other words, it seems to me that we need to take be able to be patient and take a long view to set things up. It's not going to happen immediately. It's fucked up, yes, but we're not going to solve it 100% in a radical sense because that's impossible. So you have to think ahead. You have to tolerate things that may not be to your ideals in order to keep your eye on the prize. That's what that whole term meant, keep your eye on the prize. In other words, not in the crazy things of the moment, just, you know, keep on that lodestar, that long view, you know.
I don't think
people are capable of that anymore. What? That's funny.
I think
seems
playing,
tragic
playing
to me. Yeah.
You're playing guidance counselor in the middle of a circular firing squad.
Well, maybe.
I said,
if it doesn't seem absurd to you, you're not paying attention. Yes, I agree. Yeah.
I think people can come to conclusions quicker, even though they have been dumbed down. They do understand when they
see
the price.
Well, that's part of what I'm talking about. Yeah, absolutely.
And they're fed up with it. And I think it's interesting that anti-war people are sticking stickers, both right-wing and left-wing, are sticking stickers on their gas pumps. One says, courtesy NATO, and the other one says, Biden's war. So I think it's very interesting. That's, to me, more of a—because you're not—I mean, we're not getting it. I mean, we're not getting it. We're not getting any solutions from— there was one website, StopTheDamnWars.org. I've heard. I haven't been there yet. I don't know anything. But it's supposed to be a burgeoning organization that is not, you know, going to get into these who shot John first stuff. It's either, or whataboutism.
Right.
But they are going to get into what is imperialism. And I think there is something to this.
Well, there's
no question
the United
John.
States is involved here. Yeah.
I mean, they are, you know, Chomsky just in the last 2 days came out and he says, you know, Americans are not do not appreciate the terror that other countries have towards this country, the U.S.
But Mike, I've been preaching that for 40 years. That's the whole reason I got Investor Peace.
You.
I mean,
this
for Christ's sake. I know, but that's what I mean. I'm getting lectured by people about things that I've been writing about for 40 years. I don't see the basis of that. You know, I'm not saying the United States is the good guy in this at all. I'm just saying, you know, the killing has to stop, and that why should people on the left, you know, make the exact same argument that Vladimir Putin is making to continue this war. If you look at a thing I read today, he's written something that, you know, that it's the United States is evil that we are now taking on. And, you know, the left is going, great, go ahead, we don't like it either, you know? And it's like, wait a fucking minute here. You're endorsing Vladimir Putin's motive and logic for wrecking Ukraine and killing tens of thousands of people. And, you know, all the atrocities that develop after wars get frustrating. And, you know, why I don't understand why people on the left are echoing, parroting Vladimir Putin's argument for why he's making this war. He's making this war, he said this, because of the United States' behavior in the world, which you're just talking about. And it's like, I don't get it. You know, I mean, why would you want to echo Vladimir Putin's motives for this war when you could just back up and say, wait a minute, a plague on both their houses, let's just stop the killing and we can talk about it. You know, that's my position. You know, I'm not going to say, well, because I don't like the United States, and the United States has been terrible things, and they got me to do it in Vietnam and all that, and, you know, and yada, 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 yada. I've been writing about it for 40 years. All because of that, I'm supposed to endorse Vladimir Putin's motives for killing Ukrainians. I don't get it. I don't get it. Now, maybe I'm an asshole. Okay, I don't know. But that's really how I feel these days, and I'm running into a lot of opposition on the left. But I think this is important. I think we need to talk this stuff because the left has, you know, consistently shot itself in the foot with identity politics and all this stuff. You know that we're not. It's not working. We need a new approach, it seems to me. And I think, you know, a practical kind of non-identity politics left is what's needed. But it's hard to get that because everybody's got their own favorite little thing. They flog and flog and flog and flog and send out on the internet these conspiracy, false flag this, false flag that. You know, it's like, you know, We're infantilized and stupefied at the same time. There's just so much shit coming at us. I don't know. I'm very frustrated, as you can see. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
Go ahead. Let me have it, Mike. Come on.
That's the Joe Rogan defense for everything. Yeah, I was watching that son of a bitch on Fear Factor when he was just a little punk, you know, on Fear Factor. He was making a small fortune having people eat bugs, okay,
okay.
Fear Factor, you know. I mean, he was making a small fortune, and now he, you know, now he lives, he pulled a cool $120 million from, who is it, Spotify, and moved to Texas.
Yeah, well, you and I are envious of his radio success.
But it's not envy. It's just the point. It's the utter sheer hypocrisy of unreasonable doubt. I mean, his forte is sitting around going, "I know nothing.
I see.
You're going to tell me what I know, what I need to know, and you're going to tell me what I need to see." He's sort of the Dunkoff, the Sergeant Schultz of talk show.
Okay,
host,
fair
Joe
enough.
Rogan. I mean, of a Hogan's Heroes fame. You know, he knows nothing until you tell him something. He does nothing until you ask him to do something. And it's always unreasonable doubt. And I think that as long as you live in a state of confusion, that's what comes off. It's just an unending state
of
confusion.
I think this is exactly why Rogan is successful, because people are confused and they're frightened, and there's just so much crap coming at them at every moment. That, you know, they want somebody who can project certainty. And if they buy it, they'll sign up. You know, I mean, this is why religions are so successful, because they make it simple. It's our way. This is the way it is. And, of course, there's a great authority up there that established it, so it has to be true. And there you go. And so you accept it. And it makes your life comfortable. It makes it easier than if you just had to live with confusion, and chaos. You know. Anyway, that's my existential angst at the moment. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's a good one. I want to finish with this very. I think this will be a surprise for you too.
Oh,
and
good.
The listeners. This is Max Blumenthal in Los Angeles over the weekend speaking before, it must have been about, I looked from the videotape, I'd say maybe 2,000 people in a crowd out in L.A. And I'll turn it down. If you start yelling, I'll turn it down. But this is interesting to listen to. All right, and we'll close with that. Here, listen to this speech. It's a very short speech.
I'm Max Blumenthal from thegrayzone.com, and I regret to inform you that I'm a member of the media, the worst profession in the country. Actually, I'm one of the good ones. We'll talk about that in a second. I want to talk about what's been happening in the world for the last 2 years, because for 2 years, we have seen one of the biggest grassroots movements unfold before our eyes, the medical freedom movement. which has seen millions of people around the world march against unscientific, anti-worker mandates in their own societies, from the indigenous Bolivians of El Alto to Moroccans of Casablanca to Iranians in Tehran, from Beirut to Berlin to Boston to Los Angeles. And what is this about? It's about decent working people around the world trying to hold on to their humanity, their basic rights, their bodily autonomy, and their very sanity in the face of a cold and ruthless machine that seeks to reduce every individual to a QR code and condition their participation in society and their very ability to work on their willingness to take an experimental gene therapy. That is unacceptable. And you know what else is unacceptable? Those who try to make this into a right versus left issue. All they're trying to do is confuse, divide, hoodwink, and bamboozle on behalf of the billionaire class that represents the real winners of this pandemic. This is not about left versus right. This is about our economic rights, our human rights, and our constitutional rights. And that's why we're here today. We've watched for the past 2 years as Big Pharma and its oligarchic investors puppeteered our governments, putting the FDA and CDC in its back pocket while turning our politicians into corporate sales reps, guaranteeing Pfizer and Moderna combined profits of $65,000 per minute. Per minute! Using your bodies as profit centers while working class Americans suffered the sharpest increase in poverty in 50 years. We've watched the wealth of the world's 10 richest men double since the lockdown began. We have watched small businesses be destroyed, entire countries plunge deeper into debt, while the most vulnerable youth were deprived of their right to education. And now in New York City, we watch as wealthy and famous celebrities are allowed to work without a mandate, but healthy firefighters, medical workers, and teachers, people doing the most important jobs in this country, are not allowed to work because they disobey the mandate. And we are here to say, let them work! 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 That's right! Listen to me. Listen to the profit-driven, anti-people system that I'm describing here. I'm sorry, but this is not socialism. This is corporatism. When we live in a corporate state, a ruthless, imperialist corporate state that exists in a permanent state of war and which divides to conquer and which created a false division between the vaccinated and unvaccinated in order to further shatter the solidarity of the 99%. I want to tell you about the most courageous journalist of our time. His name is Julian Assange. Make noise for Julian Assange! Free Julian Assange! Julian Assange, before he was a political prisoner, reminded us that every war of our lifetime, from Vietnam to Iraq to the NATO proxy war in Ukraine, has been sold to us with the lies of the corporate media. And this, too, is true of the war waged on the people of this country under the banner of a pandemic. Today, as we know, Julian Assange sits in a maximum security prison for exposing the lies of the national security state, and they are trying to kill him. And the same corporate apparatus that silenced Assange has set out to censor and smear anyone who is...
There you go, John. There you go.
All right. No, that was great. I wish we could talk about it. I'll talk about it later with you.
All right, brother.